All right, doing it once again from the Romy Mobile Chili Gods studio. Doing it in one take, continuing on a little bit from last week about the pandemic and masks and how it is coming back out of this pandemic. And I'm not even sure what the rules are or if it's over or, you know, I guess it's no mask if you've been vaccinated. And it's just interesting, you know, just seeing from a year and a half of seeing just quite a, you know, not that many people and always having your mask, always having your hand sanitizer, always cleaning up, always, you know, to now it's like anything goes, you know, it's crazy.
I don't know, Ethan. I don't think it's anything goes. But what I find is the bigger communities are just, let's go out, let's do our thing. And then I'm finding these pockets on my route, like Yuba City or Marysville or Woodland, or when I was over in Fort Bragg and Mendocino on Thursday, you saw...
Are those all about the same population-wise?
They're smaller communities, and they're kind of isolated, like not too many things are around them. They have, you know, Marysville, Yuba City, Woodland, those kind of communities are out in the farmland, so, you know, they're used to not seeing a lot of people anyway. They're, you know, a crowd, a circle... is smaller than most people. So it's kind of weird to see but it makes sense. Those are the ones that are still wearing the mask. And in some of the stores, they even asked the vendors to wear masks at a couple stores. So, you know, I have my mask, I'm ready. But then some of the stores I went into, they're like, oh, don't worry, you don't have to wear your mask. It's only the, you know, the employees, the butchers and the cashiers that were wearing their mask. But they said, no, you don't have to wear a mask. So, it's just a weird vibe. And, you know, we're all getting, you know, most people that I've talked to have been vaccinated. So it's just, once again, it's like you said, run through the finish line.
That's interesting, though. I wonder if it's the smaller communities. I wonder if they just didn't get the memo yet. and that's why they're still all masked up. Or if it's just the bigger communities in the city, they're used to having everybody around. And they're used to, you know,
exactly.
They've got the vaccinated. They trust the news. And they trust the science, so it's, you know,
yeah, it's definitely
mask off, and if you've been vaccinated, and, you know,
yeah,
have a nice day.
Yeah, it's definitely more a psychological thing, I think, from these areas. You know, like you said, in the city, people have been used to doing their protocol. Now that they're told it's cool, they're like, man, I just want to get out there. And, yeah. You know, the density of San Francisco compared to a Woodland or a Fort Bragg or a town of Mendocino is very, very small. And I remember when I was in a store up there, you know, 6 months ago, I heard this young kid talking to this older lady in the store, and she was in, and their sense of community is such a trip. And because the way he said it, he said, yeah, one of our friends has the virus, and he goes, and it's just, you know, it kills me because
it's scary.
It's in our community now.
Yeah.
The way he said our community is, you know, this is, you know,
a tight-knit group.
A tight-knit group. And it's funny because the store that I went to that this happened at, you know, the small world, that one guy, I guess Ken Parnell, that kidnapped the kids back in the day. And he said,
one.
Yeah, Timmy White. Yeah, it's a small world. It seems like I know everybody. But Timmy White's mother actually worked at North American Title, where I worked before me. But I met her a few times because she'd come in and talk to the girls and that I worked with, a bunch of sweethearts. And that was Timmy White's mom. And he was a little five-year-old that got kidnapped and went...
That's horrible.
Yeah, it was awful. But the lady at the store that owns the store told
that me... That probably brought that community together. I see what you're saying.
Well, no. Well, maybe. I don't know. You can tell me or I'd have to go back and ask. But what it was when they were hiding out, when he had the older kid, and he ended up... They did a movie about him, and he ended up dying in a motorcycle accident, the kid. But he saved Timmy White because he saw what this guy was going to do to Timmy White. And he said no, and it gave him the courage to come out and say this guy. And these guys told me in-depth stories. They said, yeah, he used to party with the kids in that community at parties, kegger parties in high school. And he go, yeah, I got...
Oh, what, he's just some adult weirdo?
No, the guy that got kidnapped when he was five. See, the first guy got kidnapped when he was five. I forget where he got kidnapped out of. But when he was like 16, 17, when he was getting older, the Kenneth Parnell abducted little Timmy White, a little 5-year-old, and what happened was when the guy saw what he was going to do to this kid,
he intervened,
and nice. I thought that was a hero move, and they did a movie on him, because when they brainwash you at such a young age,
and this all happened at the town at the store you're at,
up to just south of Fort Bragg, Manchester, and the owner of the store, they told me stories. They said that they used to come in and they were real quiet, like never said anything, never talked, but they lived right, you know, in the community right across the road. And one of the things he said was the kids remember him like drinking and partying with them in high school.
Yeah.
And one time he opened, because he had a few beers, and he opened up and he said, yeah, that's not my real dad. He kidnapped me and he's been molesting me. And nobody believed him. They thought he was telling, you know, just drunk and being funny, or telling a story, or just being drunk or whatever. And then afterwards, when they found out, it was like, you know, he was trying to open up. He was trying to tell people, but it was hard for him. So Timmy White, you know, got saved because of this guy. But that's a little story about Manchester, California, up there on the Mendocino Coast. Beautiful, beautiful spot. And everybody there was wearing masks, employees.
Yeah, it sounds like they're still going with the social distancing and wearing masks.
Whereas
in the cities, they seem not to be.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. Like, even at that store, because it's such a tiny little, like I said, a community, that
now is the store tiny as well? Are we talking like a mini mart or a 7-Eleven?
Oh, it's badass.
Or like a Lucky size. Safeway.
What it is? It's a grocery store tied into a
square footage.
True Valley Hardware. Oh yeah, yeah, about the size of a Lucky's, and then they have a back park. Of the area where they do you know, coffee and stuff like that, and then they have all the vegetables, and I mean, it's a full-on supermarket.
Nice.
And it's a full-on hardware store. And so when you say community for that Manchester town, you know, the town on the coast, beautiful Mendocino,
that's
coast,
a spot where you could get it all. You could go get some eggs,
but it's where everybody has to go.
Yeah,
because the next door, you know, it's 30 miles each way, and they're not even going to have that good of a selection. So Manchester is in between no man's land, so everybody in that community, they know everybody.
It's like the watering hole on the plains.
Yeah,
you see all the animals there.
Yeah, and they're great people, just down-to-earth, hard-working, great people. You know, Alan and his wife, they're just wonderful. But anyway, that's what I saw. So in little communities like that, they were still, because it's a tighter community. You know, so they don't want it. And like I said, that one kid in that source said,
yeah, it stuck out to you. When he said that.
The way he talked to the lady, he goes, it's made it into our community because everybody knows each other, whether good or bad. Like Ken Parnell, they said, and the kid, can't remember his name, but they kept coming in, but never said a word. So remember, it's the quiet ones you got to worry about. So
I'm interested in because I'm out and about and I'm just doing my normal thing, but I don't know if it's a new social etiquette or if it's just me trying to be respectful as a person, but I'm still wearing my mask when I'm going into places and doing stuff, not necessarily for myself because I've gotten the shot, or mm-hmm. but just for other people because mm-hmm. I don't know how they're feeling about it. I don't know what their level of comfortability is, and I don't know. Sometimes I'm the only one in the store with the mask on, you know. Sometimes I'm the only one at work with the mask on. Sometimes I'm the only one in the building with the mask on, you know?
Yeah.
And no one says anything, no one cares, you know? And it's just, so I don't know if that's, I don't know when the cutoff date is, or I don't know when it's gonna be like, you know,
where it's when
it
just you're comfortable. Feels,
well, I think there's more to it than that, because I think there is still, like you said, there is still certain rules and certain spots where you gotta have the masks. And what's crazy to me is seeing like sporting events and just events with crowds. I haven't seen any concerts or any comedian shows or anything like that yet, but just seeing on TV the crowds, and you know, from last year they were playing in empty buildings, you know.
Yeah.
And it's just crazy to see people elbow to elbow. Some people have masks on, some people don't, but they're jumping up, they're jumping down, they're sneezing, they're coughing, they're drinking their beers, they're right there just watching the event, and it makes the game so much more fun to watch. But at the same time, it's really odd to see all these people packed into the building like that.
Yeah, and you know, it just being an ex-athlete and singer, there's that when the crowd is you can
make
that,
or break a show.
Well, yeah, but they it goes two ways, you know, like it inspires you. So it's not you just singing or trying to do good playing sports and give a show, but you know,
they bring an energy.
The energy they're bringing back. Yeah. I mean, there's times where, you know, when I sang with the whole crowd was, and it just, you didn't want to stop. You didn't want to stop. You wanted to keep going, and it was such a natural high. Yeah. You know, I just absolutely loved it.
Yeah, it's crazy because I could pick up on exactly what you're saying, but I could pick up on that through the TV. Just the difference mm-hmm. in the playoff basketball mm-hmm. from this year to last year, you know, when there was no one. I mean, there was people in the building, of course, on the sidelines, but it was just a way different atmosphere because, I mean, it wasn't their home stadium. They were in Florida somewhere.
It felt like a private scrimmage.
Yeah, it did. It felt like when I watch like Team USA when they're trying to get into the tournament or get into the Olympics, you know, their qualifying rounds. You know, it's like four courts, you know, three games going on at the same time. It feels very low budget.
Well, you know what? That's a great word because I just felt, hey, they're not really putting the effort in. Why should I watch this?
Yeah, no, I mean, I watched every game, but there was a difference. There's levels to things, of course, and it just felt like, you know, they did the best they can, you know.
Yeah, it's hard to play in front of a camera, opposed to playing in front of a crowd. It's like karaoke and singing with a live band. If you're doing karaoke, it's all tweaking and twanging, the wrong key, the wrong.
Aren't you
thing.
Just singing over stuff? It's karaoke's just, more for fun, I thought.
Yeah, but you know what?
You don't have to be good, but people take it seriously, huh?
Oh, yeah, and that's fine. And people have great voices and stuff.
Karaoke is better when you suck.
Yeah. I've had a good time there, too.
And you go and you're just going up there, I mean, and you're just having a good time.
Yeah.
It's like booze dancing at a wedding, you know, it's all fun.
Yeah, it's all
fun. You don't have to be good. You're not trying to get tens.
No.
Or your trip to L.A.
No, and that's the fun of it. But when you're a professional singer,
oh yeah, that's different.
And
nobody paying to see karaoke.
Yeah, and people would be like, well, how come you hate karaoke so much? I go, because it makes me look bad. You know, makes me look bad because when you're singing with a live band or real people, it just you can create a certain magic.
Well, I'm sure the place is acoustically set up for that as well when you're doing that compared to a karaoke bar.
Okay, well, some of the karaoke, it's just no.
It's madness.
It's no good.
That's another indoor thing. But what I've seen is noticed with the sporting events is baseball. It seems different though because I mean they're still elbow to elbow and they pack them in, but because the stadiums are outdoors. It seems like it might be a little bit, I don't know. I don't want to use the word safer, but I mean, I'm going to.
Yeah. No, I mean, my dad worked for the Warriors in Oakland Coliseum, and he died of lung cancer. And back in those days.
You could smoke indoors?
It was indoor smoking, dude. And I remember my 20s, you know, in San Francisco partying, and I'd go to the bars with my suit, and then the next day my suit smelled like cigarette, you know?
Of course.
And it was like, oh, okay, I got to go get that clean, dry clean. So. It was a whole different atmosphere, but I agree. I agree with you. If it's outdoor, you just have the more circulation. You know, like you said, I wouldn't go up and sneeze on somebody. But
well, you don't want to do that outdoors either.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. But yeah. I agree with you. I think it's
but
a
it feels
lot
like,
safer.
Yeah, but speaking of sneezes, but yeah, the indoor place seems like if someone was just sneezing into a bag. You know, there's 50,000 people in there, and they're all sneezing and coughing. At some time, those germs is going to land somewhere.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's suppressed down.
Yeah.
Where the opening, you know, just gives you.
Seems like if you could get a wind current and it could take it away.
Exactly.
That's what you're hoping for.
You know? You know, it's going to get it, clean it out, and you know, break it down. So and I went to a game over there. In Sacramento, it's not really field anymore. This was a month or so ago. They were doing, you know, you had to be 6 feet apart, but it still felt kind of good to, you know, be at a real ball game with the sun coming in there and
got your hot dogs here.
Oh yeah,
got your hot dogs, ice cold beer. Love that.
Yeah,
there's nothing like a baseball game.
You know, they're the Giants AAA team, and there was some good.
That's the thing about baseball. It doesn't matter what level you watch it at. It seems like it's always kind of a good time. Whereas in other sports, I only want to watch the pros.
Oh, baseball. I could sit there and watch Little League, semi-pro. I mean, it's just fun because you know what? Tomorrow's stars are mixing with, you know, the kid that had no talent, the dad was a coach or something, you know what I mean? So there's still that mix. You know, it's fun to look back and say, oh, I hit a home run off this guy, or I struck this guy out. You know, they made it to the major leagues and stuff like that. So it's kind of fun because at that level, you can really see the shining stars.
Yeah, but it's crazy about that though. Is there's certain baseball players, and I think Will Clark is one of them that did that one. What is it? Little League World Series. Whatever the high school thing is
state championship.
Whatever that is, yeah. College World Series, and then the Pro World Series. But there's a couple of those guys that it's like, are you kidding me?
I did
me?
Not know that.
Yeah, I want to say Will Clark or one of those guys. I'd have to look it up. But there's a couple of those baseball players, and you're like, holy crap,
they were solid from day one. Yeah, and then I've talked to a couple of my friends lately, and they were I was 6'5" as a freshman, and
yeah,
I was playing varsity football and just mobbing people.
And
he's still a big kid. I told him he should have stuck with it. And then my other friend, you know, who broke all the school records, hit 3 home runs in a game, but he told me, you know, he's benching like, you know, 300 pounds when he was in the 8th grade. I mean, these were man-child. And I looked at those...
Growing their bodies early.
Yeah, and I looked at those guys. I said, are you kidding me? The first time I dunked a basketball, I was 30 years old. I mean,
late bloomer.
But I was a late bloomer. But yeah. The weird thing with the sports is, you know, Greg Jeffries was an all-star. And he was a rookie... voted the best rookie for
rookie of the year,
or not rookie of the year, what's best minor league baseball player like 2 years in a row. But he was man chop. He was hitting home runs left-handed, right-handed field out of Central Park in San Mateo when he's 15 years old. And when he signed the contract, you know, it was like $275 back then for signing bonus for the number one draft pick.
At what age? At like,
draft.
At
he like was 19, at 20. 19. No, he was 20. I think he was 20 because he spent 2 years in the minors. He was 20 years old. He was out of Burlingame, you know, San Mateo area, and
yeah, baseball's a trip with how many just different divisions and different teams there are before you even get to the pros.
Yeah, but this guy was a phenom, right?
Yeah,
he was eventually an all star, but
the bigs.
Yeah, for St. Louis Cardinals, he was an all star.
Oh shit!
And Greg Jeffries, yeah. And the thing about it was he told me we came and talked with us when I was playing baseball at City College with Fred Glosser. That was Michael J. Fox's son's dad, double for the move to Teen Wolf.
Stunt double, yeah.
Stunt double. And, you know, it was good times. It was good times back then, but you never knew who was going to make it big, you know, during that period of time. You didn't know. But you could see it. And that's what I'm saying. I went to the River Cats game, and man, this one second baseman, I just took one look at him and I said, man, that guy looks like a ball player. You know, and he just...
The way they carry themselves, huh?
Yeah, and he just smacked a line drive, and then the next game he hit a home run. And then there was this one guy that came up, and I'm not mentioning any names. This is AAA, right? And this one guy came up, and they threw him a curveball outside, and he swung, and he missed it by 2.5 feet. And I was
curveballs are tough.
I was like, whoa. But I could tell when he was walking up the plate, I go, this guy don't look like a hitter. So even in AAA, there's...
Was it a curveball?
Was it an
old school curveball or a breaking ball? Because it seems like when I watch the big leagues, they like put more, you know, it's more breaking balls where they just put some motion on it. I haven't seen, I don't watch a lot of baseball, but that you know, lopsided sidearm curveball like you see in college.
It to me, it just looked like a traditional...
You know, two fingers on the laces.
To me, it just looked like a curveball. It wasn't a slider. It was definitely... Maybe it was a slurve, but it was...
But he missed bad.
Oh, yeah. He was a right... He was a right-handed batter, and it was the pitch was... ended up being low and outside, you know, the way he swung, he pulled his head like he was tomahawking something.
Yeah, he got fooled.
Oh, yeah, I mean, but he got fooled by 2.5 feet. It was just like horrible. I'm just like, what the hell?
That's what I wonder about a good curveball. Like, is a good curveball at some point, is it a strike over the plate and it just ends as a ball? Or is a good curveball just look like it's going to be a strike and then it just dips on you?
Mm.
You know, because I don't know. Because I was one of those people, you know, those high and outside ones. those ones that are hard to lay off, I would swing at those.
Well, I tell you, with the hardest one to hit, and this is a credit to Bert Blyleven. We're going back to back to the 70s.
Say that name three times fast.
Bert Blyleven. He played for the Minnesota Twins, as I recall, and somewhere else. But he was an outstanding pitcher in the 70s. And this guy had such an amazing... The break on his curveball was so big. So yeah. this is going to answer your question, I think. That one time, it was a game of the week, he threw the ball at the right-handed batter.
He a lefty or righty?
He was a righty.
Okay.
And he threw the ball at the right-handed batter. And the right-handed batter... Now, this is a game of the week, so these guys are pumped
Everybody's
up.
Watching.
Yeah, the whole night. If you're baseball and you're not out there playing on Saturday, you were
it's
watching...
the only game on.
Kirk Gowdy and... not Kirk Gowdy. Joe Gargiola and... I forget the other guy's name, but they were great.
They were the announcers?
Yeah, the ex-players. They were great. They were just the best announcers ever. And Bert threw this one... And the guy hits a deck. I mean, he just drops his bat and then hits the ground because he thought it was going to hit him. And then the umpire goes, strike. So if the curve is that good, I used to do, and I had a wicked breaking curveball I loved. It wasn't my number one thing, but I loved to pitch because you could fuck with people, their balance and everything.
Oh, yeah.
And he threw one that, you know, made this guy... duck, and it was so how are you going to hit that, because it's coming right at you, and the hardest,
you gotta sit in there,
the hardest, yeah, but the hardest, that's where you're saying, here's the plate,
yeah, no,
and he probably got the back of, he might not even got the front of the plate, but the way was curving,
knees to armpits, right?
I'm talking about the
strike zone,
the strike zone,
yeah.
Let's say so that ball was inside. It was inside, but as it's curving, it gets its most break at the end of a curve is when you get the most break. So it could have curved around the front of the plate is what I'm saying.
Yeah,
and
just
nicked that back corner. Because you know how a baseball plate is.
Yeah, it's a diamond.
So he could
have. It's not a diamond, but it's like half of one.
I mean, if you in instant replay, you could break it down and look at that curveball, and that's how good it was. So how are you going to hit that?
You got to sit in there. It's like how you catch a bullet.
But
you know what I mean?
The only thing you could do is just...
Yeah, it's a check swing.
Check swing.
You have to T-Rex arm it.
And try to bloop it over the second baseman's head.
Yeah, you got to just let that one go.
Yeah, and but that's how good...
I don't know if you want to hit the deck, though. That sounds embarrassing.
But that's how good this pitch was. Well, and that's what I'm getting at. Because the best curve I ever threw...
Yeah.
Ever threw in my life.
Remember it.
Oh, I remember it because I was always throwing curves to see how far I could break and knuckleballs and all that shit. But there was one that I threw, and it was we were playing. I was playing at City College of San Francisco with Fred Glosser, the coach out there, and he was going to put me in for relief. And he goes, "Yeah, go throw in the bat. The bullpen, right?" So the catcher, he was from Mission High School in San Francisco. Great kid. And he was catching the ball, my warm-ups.
Yeah.
And I threw him a curveball, and he stood up.
The catcher?
He started to stand up because he thought it was...
Oh, okay.
It was so high, and then he pulled his... He jumped down and moved his hand and caught it.
Yeah.
And what it was... It reminded me of that Bert Blyleven pitch because there was no batter. It was just the bullpen.
Yeah.
But it had that curve where my catcher... got fooled. It broke so much, and
that's interesting. So it went top. It went up to up down. Because I always think of a curve as going right to left.
A lot of people I remember told me a curve is actually straight over the top. But I threw it over the top. I threw it from the side because I like pitching, keeping people off their balance. So if you didn't throw the exact same pitch, I talked to good pitchers back in the day, and they always told me I never hardly ever throw my 100% fastball. I always take a little off it.
That's why they're in the 95 when the guys could probably hit 103.
Yeah.
I don't know.
You know, it makes a difference.
Yeah.
When we played Chabot that year, and I got Darren Lewis out. He played for the Giants. I went through the whole lineup. They were in first place. Coach put me in for three innings. I got everybody out, except for one kid. And what he did was I threw my changeup was actually my best because it would just drop in on the right-handed batter. And he, you said that T-Rex thing?
Yeah, a little check
swing. He did a little check swing and it hit it right over the second baseman's head.
Oh, that's almost like a softball hit.
Oh, dude, it was so funny. And I was like, he got fooled on it, but he kept, like you said, he kept his hands back.
Yeah.
And he was able to.
He probably kept his chin down, right? You know what I mean? He didn't pull his head.
He was a
good batter.
Yeah, he was the only guy on the whole lineup. They were in first place.
He earned it.
Yeah, and I said, good job.
People that know that's a good hit.
Yeah, because and I know I remember
those are hard pitches to hit.
And I placed it perfect. I placed it where it was going, looked like it was going to be across the plate, the inside a little bit.
So if he would have full swung, he would have missed by or hit it off the skinny part of that bat. Yeah. That's a little elbow ringer.
Because my changeup, I always squeezed and pulled it down like a lampshade and then dragged my back foot, but I'd always put a little finger pressure on it so it would always drop down.
A little razzle-dazzle, they call it.
Right-handed, just a little bit of push.
Yeah.
When I was pushing just at the end, and that thing would always, at the end, drop down. So it was almost like what did Fernando Valenzuela throw? He threw what they call a screwball. I couldn't throw a screwball fast. I tried. I would always try, and I couldn't throw a screwball fast. But if my changeup would do that, was it my toughest pitch? It was my toughest.
Sounds
pitch.
Like it.
But the curve that he caught it. He stood up and then he had to reach down and caught it. And he's like, he just looked at me and goes, "God damn, what was that?" And I was like, "Hey, never did it that good again before or after." But it was just a masterpiece.
One in a million.
And yeah, it was the best curveball ever threw. But Bert Blylevin, that guy, it amazed me. So back to your hitting, if it was that kind of curve, you pretty much have zero to no chance to do something with that pitch. But if the guy threw me a slider or a curveball, Calvin Chapman was the one that got me to learn how to hit the opposite field. And he told me, he played for the Mets. I played with him at Mendocino Junior College in winter ball. He worked out with us. And he always told me, when you step into a pitch, keep your hands back, because if you're going to follow through, you're already in locked motion. But if it's
elbow up.
But if it's an elbow, no, he didn't care about the elbow. He just said keep the hands back. And then if it was slow or an outside or a changeup, and you were fooled, and your body weight was there, your hands were still back, so you'd have the trigger. And I think I mentioned to you one time, my friend James Campbell got fooled on a pitch so bad. This guy played for the Royals, made it all the way to the big leagues, and won one game and threw his arm out. So he was undefeated in Major League Baseball, just like
he only got to play one game.
I think he played two. James Campbell, he was out of Oroville, California, and a great kid. But when I played with him in the summer program up there at Butte College, this kid, he was all-star center fielder. He didn't even go to pitch until he went to Arizona State or San Diego State, I think it was, and then he made it to the major leagues.
Nice.
Great kid. And he got fooled on a pitch when we were at Butte College. Was so far out in front of it that he was about ready to fall down.
Yeah.
But he kept his hands back, right? And I never seen anything like it before after he kept his hands back. So he had no body left to give that ball energy. And he just did a check swing.
Yeah.
With left-handed. He was lefty like, he batted lefty like me. And threw lefty, I threw right. And he just dinked it. And it went all the way to the wall, off the wall.
That's all wrist?
Yeah, yeah, but that's also the sweet part of the bat.
Oh yeah,
and these
metal bats, wood.
Oh, this was junior college, so we use aluminum.
Yeah, big barrel Easton probably.
But you it's like that curve. You see something like that, you never forget it because it was like, how the hell did he do that?
Yeah, some Bo Jackson stuff around the wall.
And I want to say one time he bunted and ended up on second. I think he got a double. The guy was an amazing, he would miss second base sometimes. He always hit these triples, and then they'd call him out because he just would miss second. But that was the only flaw in his game. He would miss second when he hit a triple.
Yeah, sounds like it.
But great kid.
So when at the ballpark, at the ballpark is different than in indoor sporting events. What's your go-to? Like, are you like a nachos, hot dog? I get an ice cold beer, of course, but. Peanuts. You go with the Polish. I like a Polish dog too.
100%.
Yeah, I don't put the sauerkraut on it, but I like the mustard, mayonnaise, relish. I do the onions.
I do. I like the sauerkraut and the onions, and then just a little regular mustard, because they don't have Chili God's holy mustard at the stadiums yet.
Coming to a stadium near you, holy mustard sauce. But yeah, the hot dogs are as well are good. You know, in some spots, like they got the Dodger dog. I know the Dodger dog is world famous. You know, in the LA stadiums.
Really? What is it?
I don't know. It's just their hot dog.
But you know what? Just
it's just a big hot dog.
It's just like we talked about when somebody else makes a cup of coffee for you, or you know, makes a meal for you. It always tastes better. I think no matter what the hot dog is, it's gonna taste good at a baseball game.
Oh yeah, it's the atmosphere.
You know, and even though they're outrageously priced, you can't go to a ball game and not have one in a beer, like you said, unfortunately.
No, it's all part. It's it's just like parking. It's all of it. It's an expensive day.
Yeah. So I can see why a lot of people watch it on TV, but there's nothing like being at the real game and the pressure. And you could have all eyes on you on TV, but when you have all eyes on you in real life, wow, that's some pressure. That's some added pressure.
Yeah,
you know, to perform and do your best. So, I love the atmosphere of a real game.
Yeah, the hot dogs are good. I like the Polish dog just because you could get a hot dog anywhere, but a good Polish dog or some sort of sausage is good like that. Now, oh, the man. Nachos are good, but the nachos, depending on where you go, like, I don't mind just the processed cheese and all that stuff like that, but the nachos that stick out to me that I used to always like to have is they weren't at a major league park. It was more the nachos that you'd get in Little League. They were the Fritos chips with the chili and processed
Fritos
cheese.
Chips?
Yeah, they used the Fritos corn chips.
Oh, Andrew, I never had that one.
Yeah, so it's Fritos corn chips.
I thought you were
talking
about those real, almost stale round ones that was like a First Communion thing.
No. Oh. These are the Fritos corn chips. And then they make chili ones now as well. But yeah, they were the Fritos chips, corn chips, chili, and then the processed just orange cheese, you know, the Velveeta melted cheese. That's just so good.
Who could go wrong with that? I love that. But, and then what about the jalapenos on top?
I didn't do it like that because they just didn't come like that.
Oh, okay. Where we used to have them, they had the jalapenos, and I would always just... But they let you put your own on there, so I would just douse them
in there, yeah.
And onions, and just sometimes relish, and just make it like, just extra special.
Yeah, know? No, but these were different because it was, I don't know, depending on where you played, or where if you were at home or away or wherever, they did them different like that, because some places it was in, like, you know how you get fries, whatever, it's just in like one of those little bins. So sometimes it'd be like that, but then sometimes they'd make them in the little like the sandwich, the school lunch bag of chips. So they just open the bag of chips and then pour the cheese and the nachos inside the actual bag, and you'd eat it with the fork.
Yeah, well, it was gonna get messy no matter what you did.
And when they did it like that, you could get it with all different kinds of chips. I mean, now you could do it with Doritos.
Wait, you could order different?
Yeah, because they do it. They just open the bag of chips and pour the stuff on top of that. So that was your container.
So you got to decide
pick your
which
chips.
Oh, that's... Where was this?
I don't know. It's just different places growing up, you know, playing Little League and stuff like that.
Wow.
I did traveling teams and stuff like that.
What a good idea.
Yeah. But those were the two different ways they came. And that's what, like you're saying, like the atmosphere and the ballparks and the food. But that's a memory that sticks out to me, is those were delicious.
Yeah. And it always tastes better at the ball game.
Yeah, for sure. And that was something like I would even eat those before the game, because it was like that, you know, as a kid you got an iron stomach, so it didn't matter.
So what do you think of Ethan, of that one kid that's starting pitcher and a leadoff batter? I forget his name, but I guess it's the first time it's been...
Oh, since Babe Ruth? Oh, yeah. I know you're talking about for the Angels.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no, he's dope. Yeah, he's leading the league in home runs. I haven't watched much baseball recently this year. I don't know why. What are you talking about? I don't understand, because the pitchers is hard. They're great athletes. Like, I never got why they don't hit. I guess because it's different muscle memory, and they just want to concentrate on pitching, and they make hundreds of millions of dollars for being pitching, and it's so important. But they're amazing athletes, and there's, you know, I remember, what was homeboy for the Giants? He used to hit home runs quite regularly.
Bumgarner.
Yeah, Bumgarner, there you go.
Well, but look at my buddy that made it all the way up with the Royals, James Cameron, we were just talking about. That guy was MVP of the Golden Valley Conference, I think it was, up there, Butte College, and won the MVP of the league as a center fielder, and a cleanup hitter.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, a guy just, and there's another man child, my buddy, Tom Bird, I went to school with up there. He played Little League with him, and he said, dude, he tells me stories about James Campbell, because I guess he was as big as he was back when they were in seventh grade. And he said he was the biggest kid, and nobody wanted to get up against him in Little League because he threw so hard, you know.
Oh, I see, yeah, but, scared of the pitch.
Yeah, they were scared to death of him, but Tom was on his team, so he wasn't worried.
Still got hit in practice.
And he was a lefty. So the guy, and I used to play catch with him, the guy had some good stuff. But he was also a great hitter. So,
but yeah, that's in high school, in college.
This was college.
Oh, yeah, but that's what I'm saying. It seems like in high school and college that they are the best athletes, the pitchers are usually, and they do hit. They hit, you know, they hit as well. But then when they go to the pros, it seems like they just specialize. And I get it. It's an investment.
Yeah, and you see some of those.
But I think it's awesome that the Angels are letting them do this, because it's depending on the team. You know, I don't know if that before he came over from Japan, I don't know if that was some of his stipulations of like, I'm going to do both. And that's how he chose his team or what. But some teams might not let him do that.
Well, he's just an amazing
athlete. Yeah, athlete. His last name is Ohtani, though. I know that.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know how to pronounce his first name. It's O'Shea. You know, I don't know.
Well, let's give the kid props.
Yeah, but it's awesome. It's because, I mean, it's way before our time, of course, and there's no footage of it. But, I mean, this is the first time, technically, since Babe Ruth.
Yeah, and you know, I think you nailed it, because I think when you're at the high school and college level, like you said, the best athletes and do everything. And but when you get a little higher, they want you to specialize. Everybody can be a Bo Jackson or a Deion Sanders or a Frank Yates. You know, it just doesn't work that way. So when you're playing out there, a lot of times they want to focus you on one position.
Yes, you're specialized.
Yeah, and it's funny because...
And I get it. It's just like in high school, you play both ways in football, but not in the pros and not in college.
Yeah, and I didn't even... The funny thing is, I didn't even play in high school. I got cut freshman year because I was so small. You know, all my friends were man-childs. And here I was, you know, had the squeaky high voice. And...
Late bloomer, like you said.
Yeah, but it was funny because I remember the one of the Cleveland Indian scout, when I was 24 years old, told me that he goes, if I could clone you, you could start at every position at Division I. And the Mets loved that about me. But the Seattle Mariners hated that about me. Oh, you got to be a catcher. Or you got to be a shortstop. You can't do both. And it was so funny because that's when...
Because that seems like at that time that would have been the time of the utility player. Remember that guy?
Yeah.
There's no
longer
utility.
Who was that guy, Akendo, that played every single position in the major leagues? He was for the Cardinals.
Yeah.
They
don't do that anymore. Like, yeah.
You know, and they didn't make him like that. But here it is. You know, we're talking about, you know, where one person loves you and one person hates you. You love cilantro. Somebody hates cilantro. It tastes like soap. But it was like the funny thing about the Seattle Mariners, when I got invited to their tryout, I told them I want to be a catcher and a shortstop, and the whole thing about the whole experience was, you know, here I am with the running. They tested everybody in the 50-yard dash, and afterwards, I ran with the fastest kid, and afterwards the coach goes, I go, who won? And he goes, oh, he won. He's got the fastest time. And you can't tell because it's a 50-yard dash.
Yeah.
You know, so it looked like, you know, it's only a matter of, there's not that big of a difference between fast and average, you know, and average speed. And then I said, we're really interested in him. And I said, well, how was my speed? And he goes, you're average. And, you know, I never got thrown up because I was average speed, but I was a great base stealer.
Well, it's game speed, just like Jerry Rice.
Yeah, and I had people always said I was the quickest guy they ever seen, you know. But I had average speed, you know. So I go, okay, coach, what can I do to improve it? And he looked at me and he just said, nothing. It's a God-given talent. And then my buddy whispered to me right afterwards, he goes, that's why Seattle's in last place. You can't have an attitude like that. And here he is.
He didn't want to take the time. They already had their guy.
I'm not interested in you, and I never got thrown out. It's like the guy that came for the Oakland A's back when Charlie Finney grabbed that Herb Washington, won the gold medal in the hurdle, said, man, I'm going to take the fastest guy in the world, and he's going to steal the base every time. It was a flop.
Yeah.
It was a flop. The guy.
Well, you got to, yeah.
It's not about speed. It's about quickness and getting that jump. And Ricky Henderson.
It's there's got to be a sports IQ there. You got to know when to go and know when not to go. You got to know how far to take your lead. You know, because most base stealing is the guy who gets his jump before the guy even goes to the home plate. You know, the ball's still in his hand when he makes his break.
Well,
that's how Ricky used to do it anyways. Because once he commits to home, then you could take that extra step.
You're gone.
Yeah, and then
gone. I saw Lou Brock. He would do it intentionally. He would get such a big jump and go
like 2-3 steps. And you see him. It's almost like they're leopards.
That's a delayed steal. But what he would do.
Man, you got to get a lead though.
But what he would do sometimes is he would break and have the guy throw over there because he knew he could beat the throw from first. From the pitcher to first to second, and he would do it. But he had, like you said, he had to do that little thing where he it was almost like a delayed steal. It was like in between a delayed steal and a straight steal. But the guy, and that's how since I didn't play in high school, the two people I learned how to steal bases from was Ricky Henderson and Lou Brock, because I read that Lou Brock said that if you're gonna steal the base, don't take a big lead, because then the pitcher's gonna be kind of more relaxed and you'll get a better jump. But what you would do to fuck with the pitcher is take a huge lead, but any movement, your first thing was back. But then you're getting in the pitcher's head because you're taking this huge lead.
Yeah, theoretically.
And when I read that, Jim Lauer, baseball coach at Butte College, taught me how to do delayed steal. I would straight steal, delayed steal, whatever. I always stole the base, and it was fun. It was fun. But it wasn't about being fast. It wasn't, having the fastest speed. It was about quickness.
Yeah, it's a timing thing. You got to get that jump.
Yeah, and then so we had an inter-squad game because, you know, there was about 40 guys, 50 guys out there that were invited to this tryout. It was out in Benicia. And me and my buddy knocked in two of our runs, and we go into the bottom of the ninth inning winning 3-1, you know. So we're doing, me and Danny knocked in a couple runs. He played with me at City College of San Francisco, Danny Bright, great kid. And, I'm playing shortstop at the end of the game, and I get two tailor-made double plays right to me, and I toss it to the second baseman in perfect throws, and he drops both of them. And one of the coaches comes out and explains to him how to catch the ball.
Yeah, just put the glove up if you can't do anything else.
But what I'm saying is he stops the game because this kid's a loser. And
well, I don't know. I mean, especially, I don't know if you want to go there.
Well, no, I mean, I'm not saying the kid's a loser. I take that back. The coach was a loser because what he was doing was...
In your eyes, it wasn't necessary.
It wasn't necessary. It was that kid didn't deserve to be out there, but his dad knew somebody, and maybe he didn't even want to be out there, you know? The coach, it showed favoritism,
maybe, yeah, but coaching, all the kids got to play. But you know what's crazy about baseball, and it's odd to me, especially going back to stadium food, is you notice how... Have you ever gotten a burger at a game?
They're kind of dry and not that big.
But it seems like hot dogs are somehow the food of choice.
Are you talking pro or Little League?
I'm talking anywhere.
Oh, I was thinking Little League they'd have them, but they also are real thin, dry.
Yeah, ones. Little hockey puck ones. But yeah. No, it seems like at baseball, a hot dog and a beer is the standard operating procedure. You know, but a lot of people don't eat hot dogs and don't like hot dogs, but they'll eat them at a baseball game.
Well, remember what Chevrolet said, baseball, apple pie, Chevrolet. I mean, it was part of their thing.
That's the slogan.
The slogan, you know, the base.
That's
it's a marketing traditional
campaign.
You know,
yeah.
It's traditional.
No, like apple pie.
You go.
Fireworks on the 4th of July.
Apple pie, fireworks on the 4th of July. I think I'm going to get a Kozlowski pie for the 4th of July.
Yeah. So, you know what I mean? Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It just seems like there's standard traditions. Or maybe not traditions isn't the right word for it, but it's just odd that, you know, burgers are something like most people would get. Or maybe I'm just speaking for myself.
No.
At a barbecue, they're going to go with burgers more than hot dogs. Hot dogs are more something like the kids get or something like that. But at a baseball game, it's everybody gets a hot dog. Everybody gets an ice cold beer. Everybody eats
some
peanuts.
Not everybody.
But you know what I'm saying.
All right. Sorry. I got to tell my first beer story at a ball game. My dad worked for the Oakland Coliseum, and I would read the programs and know everybody's names and the stats and everything. And I was like a little nerdy kid, right? And these guys went to school with Charles Johnson. And Charles Johnson played for the Warriors back in the 70s, championship team, and actually went to Sequoia High School. So these kids were there, and they're older because they're, you know, 26, 27, watching their buddy who played at Cal Berkeley and made it to the Warriors, watching them play. And sometimes I'd like to sit in the nosebleed seat. Sometimes I'd sit down behind the bench with the Warriors doctor who was four houses down from us. and watch the game, you know, courtside. But I'd like to go up to the top and get the view, the perspective from the very top. Yeah. It was kind of fun to watch it because you're the action, you know, it's so small looking down. And so, so what I'm saying is that these guys are there, so I'm telling them all about their players and everything, and they're really impressed with me.
Yeah.
So the guy comes up to get the beer, the older guy, and he goes, how many beer? Now remember, I'm in the seventh grade.
Yeah, so what is that, 12, 13?
Yeah, I was a late.
It's not 21.
No, not even close. And this is the 70s.
A different time.
And so what I did was I was telling these guys all the stuff about the sports.
Yeah.
And they were impressed with me.
They're called stats.
The stats and everything. And so when the guy came up, and back then they had the tall beers. And when the guy, the vendor came
what
up,
what were they, 75 cents? I'm kidding.
I don't know, maybe 50, 75.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we're talking about the 70s.
Okay,
we're
yeah, no, you're right,
early
you're right.
70s, right?
Yeah, because now I think they're like $37.
Yeah, it's crazy. I always bring my own. Two in the boot. That's
right.
Super tea. But anyway, so the guy said, hey, how many beers? And he's like, and the guy, the lead guy that I was sitting next to, he was the lead guy. Him and I were doing most of the talking.
Yeah.
But I think I was entertaining all of them. He goes, let's see, Johnny, Fred, yeah, hey, you want a beer too? And I looked, I go, yeah. And he goes, okay, make that seven beers. And I just shut my mouth like, if yeah. this guy serves me, a seventh grader, 12-year-old who was a late bloomer, a beer, I'm going to take it.
Yeah.
That's Irish in me. You know what I mean?
It's pretty standard.
I'm going to take it and keep my mouth shut. Right?
Well, you got to open it to drink it, but other than
No. These are the big, tall cups. They were the big Dixie cups, but they were the big. There was 16 ounces at least.
No, I hear you. You know? You still got to open your mouth to drink.
That was the joke.
So
I drank with these guys and talked to them about stats and explained everything.
Yeah.
No.
Did you explain to them about the drinking age?
No. No. I hate to say it, but there was nothing wrong with it.
No.
It wasn't like these guys were trying to get.
There's no malicious.
There was not. No.
It's a rite of passage.
Yeah. And I'll tell you.
It's a beer at a ball game.
And I'll tell you the reverse story after that. But so I'm sitting there, and then the guy, and this is back when you could drink in the fourth quarter and you could drink in the
ninth. Oh, no seventh inning stretch.
No seventh inning stretch stop.
Yeah, before, yeah.
People used to get hammered. And I was there as a kid. I saw it all.
Yeah.
I saw it all.
The way they do it now is probably better.
Oh, definitely. So I'm sitting there, and the guy comes back again. He comes back around. He goes, okay, you want another one? Yeah, we'll take another round. Thanks, partner. You know, seven beers, boom,
yeah.
Down the whole line of
so
us.
So you had two. So that's a 32-ouncer.
Dude, two tallies. And back then I weighed 85 pounds. Yeah, I weighed 85 pounds. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so your stats were not getting as clear.
I handled it. I maintained. And
there you go.
This is where I was a natural, like a fish in water, man. I went back to my dad, and I knew that I had a nice buzz, but my first buzz, my first real buzz, and I had a good buzz. I wasn't staggering drunk. I wasn't saying anything.
They call that sloppy.
Yeah, I wasn't sloppy one bit because I was rattling stats and I was sipping the beer with these guys, but nobody put me under the table that night. And the funny thing is when I went down, I said, man, I got to keep my away from my dad so he doesn't smell it on my breath. You know, I was smart enough to know that.
Yeah.
And so when we went back down and my dad's counting the money, you know, because he was in charge of programs and souvenirs out there with Bill Fritz, that I had to just sit down and keep my mouth shut. So I sat down and my dad goes, hey, you okay, Frank? And all I said was, oh, Dad, it's okay. I'm just really tired. You know?
There you go.
Because then I didn't have to talk, and I didn't have to get in his face. And the whole ride home was wonderful because we'd always go by the Nimitz Freeway before that earthquake, and it smelled like...
And this was at an A's game?
No. My dad worked for the Warriors.
Oh, okay.
But I got
the indoors.
Oh, yeah. But I got all the day... Went to all the day on the greens and stuff like that, and baseball games and football games. I was there with Nolan Ryan... Not Nolan Ryan. Gaylord Perry had won 16 games in a row when he was playing for the Cleveland Indians, and the A's beat him in the bottom of the ninth inning. And I was at that game.
Broke his streak?
Yeah, broke his streak. I was at that game. But yeah, my dad got us in. In fact, my first baseball game, I think, was an A's game when I was 5 years old.
The A's games used to, yeah, I haven't been to one in years, but they used to be able to get bleacher seats for like $12.
Well, Candlestick Park when I was a kid, 50 cents. But hey, who's talking money? So I got to tell you, and like you said, there was nothing malicious. But I got
no, of course not.
I got to tell you, the opposite, me being on the opposite end of it was, and I'm pushing 40 at the time, you know, and I was a skateboarder. I got cut from the baseball and basketball team in high school, so freshman year. So I said, okay, I'm not a quitter, so I'm going to go do pole vaulting and skateboarding. So I got into skateboarding, and then years later, I was mentoring a kid that had ADD and all that kind of stuff. His mom wanted me to keep an eye on him, keep him out of trouble. And so he was over at my house because he got kicked out of every high school in San Jose at the time when I was living down there. And I'm like, God, I got to go pick up my truck, but nobody's around and there's no public transportation like when I grew up in San Francisco. How am I going to get, you know,
from A to
three miles down the road to pick up my truck? And he goes, the kid, he was 15 at the time. He goes, dude, I seen that old skateboard in your closet. Let's just skate over there. And I said, oh my God, that's brilliant. So we just skated across town and picked up my car and drove back. And I go, dude, that was fun. And he let me try his new skateboard with the kick things on both sides and the whole thing. And I was like, dude, that's fun. So how I mentored him was he was getting in a lot of trouble going into
Were you doing ollies and stuff? Ollieing.
Yeah, he taught me how to do. I wasn't that good at ollieing, but I did ramps and coped on 10-foot ramps and did stuff that I never dreamed I would have done when I was younger. We didn't have the technology or the best boards back then.
Yeah, what was it? You could skate pools.
Yeah, and so we did stuff like that and got pretty good. But the funny thing to the story is, now I just want to preface it with that I got into skateboarding my second coming, and it was awesome. I had
some late bloomer
again. And so when I first moved back to Santa Rosa, you know, I helped design the Healdsburg skateboard park, and I'd go to all the skateboard parks, you know, for exercise, you know, and to do my thing. So one day I was over at the one in Sonoma. And I'm sitting there, and it's the middle of the day, and it's me, maybe about five kids, you know, just doing tricks and having fun. And I sat down to take a break, and I'm talking to the kids, and they're all, you know, around 13 years old, you know, 12 to 15 years old, you know, something.
Skateboard age.
Yeah, skateboard age, you know, and here I am, you know, 40 years old. And I'm talking to the kids, and they were all nice kids. And there was one kid, and I'll never forget it. It was one kid, and he said, "Hey, man, what are you doing with the rest of the day?" And I'm like, "Going, oh, nothing. I finished all my deliveries. I'm just chilling." He goes, "Hey, dude, let's go get some beer and hang out." And I'm like, "Oh no, dude, I'm not gonna buy you."
They're trying to get you to be a buyer.
Yeah, and I was like, but it was so funny because how many times was I on the end of that?
Yeah,
trying to get a buyer or and stuff.
Yeah, you can't buy beer for the kids. Yeah, but that reminds me of...
But I looked at the kid and I told him, I said, you know what? I have to respect you trying, but I got...
You got to respect the hustle, but yeah.
Yeah, you know.
I get it.
Respect the hustle, but I said, I can't do that, man.
Yeah, no.
I'm 40 years old.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, go find someone else. But but that reminds me of what's going to be awesome now with the pandemic over in baseball, especially is tailgating. Tailgating is
my
awesome.
Favorite.
Yeah, because what's so funny about tailgating to me is I've seen it done on TV and I've seen all those other things where they have the barbecue and all that other stuff. But whenever I've done tailgating, it's just we got there early and we probably had some food we picked up and we were just drinking.
Yeah, it's an excuse to party.
Yeah.
I mean, I went to a couple 49er tailgate parties back in the day. You know, back in the late 80s. And
Joe Montana, Jerry Rice.
Yeah. Oh,
just
my God.
Just doing it, man. How blessed were we? Joe Montana, Joe, and then Steve Young back to back.
Gosh. I mean,
Bill Walsh.
Surest thing to win back then is betting 49ers.
Yeah.
I
was so lucky and blessed. Those were my teams growing up. I mean, the Warriors weren't doing so hot, but the Niners were always there. The Giants were always pretty good. There was the Battle of the Bay. It was Bay Area sports.
Yeah, we've had a lot of championships in the Bay Area.
Yeah, blessed.
We were very blessed, and our tailgate parties were phenomenal. I remember you know, back in the 80s. And I was a big barbecue guy. My mom bought me a hibachi when I was, you know, 8 years old, and I was so excited, like, oh my God, I could cook open barbecue. You know, it was just a little hibachi, and I would cook for the family and stuff. I love that little thing. But I didn't, we weren't marinating back then as much as we do now, or at least my family.
Dry cooking.
It was a lot of, you know, dry cooking, but you'd chop up the onions and put it in with the hamburger meat.
Okay.
And stuff like that.
Chunks, and you dice the onions when you do it like that, right?
Yeah, but you weren't.
Almost like a meatloaf burger.
Yeah, exactly. And we do, but I'll never forget it. And we're at the tailgate party, and one of the guys was barbecuing, and he actually had played for the Raiders.
Oh, wow.
He was a big, big guy. My friend Paul knew him. I can't remember his name off there. But he actually played for the Raiders, big guy. But he was barbecuing.
He was on the grill. Was he doing ribs? Was he doing burgers? Was he doing everything?
He was doing pork.
Okay.
He had all this pork that he had marinated.
Yeah.
And I took a bite of his pork, and I said, dude, how did you make that pork so tender? It just melted in my mouth.
Yeah.
I mean, a couple bites, and it just, it was the best barbecued I'd ever had. Seriously. I mean, up until that point.
Well, yeah, for sure.
And I said, dude, what's your secret? And he said, oh, dude, I've marinated. I just let this sit for 3 or 4 days.
There you go.
And I was like, what? I go, doesn't the meat go bad? You know? And he goes, no, dude, all that stuff gets in there. And I said, it's more tender and everything. And ever since then, I was this is back in the late 80s. I was a firm marinator. I mean, if you can let, so don't let sit too long.
Well, of course not.
But if the chicken, you don't want to marinate that more than a day or two. But
always the same day.
But the pork, yeah, I mean, a lot of times we don't have a choice. But if you can let that set 3 or 4 days, boy.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, marinades are amazing, and even a dry rub, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and just, depending on the
meat that you're taking.
Yeah, just a dry rub or whatever, or if it's a tri-tip or some sort of meat, just cutting a couple holes in it, or not more than a couple, and then putting in some garlic. There's all kinds of little interesting tricks that you can do to just really spice up that meat.
Yeah, and that's one I forgot about, that one. When you do a rub, you don't have, it's a lot of time you don't have time, but it crystallizes.
Yeah.
It gets in that outer skin and it locks in the flavor.
Yeah.
So even though it doesn't get all the way through to the meat like a marinade would, you're getting that flavor.
It's on that crust.
In the top and the bottom of it. I do both sides, but when I would barbecue and stuff. But yeah, that's the other way to go. That, and speaking of which, we're gonna bring back our Lunar Love Rub under the Chili Gods label.
There you go. Something to look forward to.
Yeah, so that'll be a winter project.
Nice. But yeah, tailgating to me it seems awesome, and it's one of those traditions that it's fun to do before the game. But I've always wanted to do it, like you see it, like those diehard fans that do it in the snow. They got the Winnebago, they got the, you know, they're out there with their scarves, and then they're out there barbecuing, and it just seems amazing. Like that would be fun enough without even watching the game. They're having a blast before 9 a.m.
Oh yeah, yeah, and it, you know, and it's just the attitude. And the camaraderie, because when I went to Minnesota, the kids that were partying down the block, well, kids, they were in their 20s, but kids to me, and we went over, and I went over there into their house, and they had this huge blower in the garage, you know, butane blower, and then they're all sitting out in their parkas drinking beer. And
yeah.
I'm like, well, why? How come you guys don't drink in the house? You know, and it's like, well, this is our garage. This is where we drink and party.
That's where
they, but they were wearing parkas, and we started having a good time.
Where you can see your breath.
Yeah, but then we were warm because we had our thick jackets on, and then we did have the heater. So, but it was fun. So I was like, okay, and they were great kids.
Yeah, it's just like, it's one of those things like we talk about with all these things. It's the atmosphere. It's almost not what you do it or how you do it. It's who you do it with.
The way
you do it isn't that important.
That's it.
Yeah, and it's interesting though, especially like you were talking about, we were talking about earlier before we started, it was about the restaurants that you went to this week, the ones that survived, the ones that made it. You know, I don't know if there's certain types of restaurants that made it and certain ones that didn't, if they were just like the local favorites. But you visited a couple restaurants this week, didn't you?
Oh yeah, absolutely. It was a pleasure, like I said before, to get back and be able to go all to these restaurants. I'm at Fort Bragg. I was at Sea Pal, Best Fish and Chips. you'll ever have. I dream about them all the time.
Fish and chips.
Oh, all the time I dream. God, I wish. And but so when I go up there, the guys always hook me up with a batch, and the
tartar sauce.
Oh, I put everything. I put the.
Do you put salsa in the tartar sauce?
What? No. What I do is I do the vinegar. They have the vinegar, and I put that over the chips and the fish and everything, and then I do the lemon.
Oh, yum! Yeah, lemon for sure.
And then they have the best tartar sauce, and then I just sit there. Oh God!
And what is that? Is that a cod? What is normally they use for the fish and chips? Yeah, the cod. And then what are the fries?
These were the thick like steak fries.
Steak fries, okay. But that's how I picture it. A lot of salt or no salt? You got to add your own salt.
Just a little bit. I don't like when people put too much salt in on. I don't get it. They're like they'll just pour the salt. But these guys,
I'm a salt guy on fries.
No, I have to have salt on fries. But it's just, it's just these guys put the perfect amount. You know what I mean? Because salt to me is you don't want to overtake it, but you want it to be subtle, but you need it there.
Just as an extra, an afterthought. I get it.
Yeah, and so...
you're not a deer.
These guys, and there's always a line out the back, and these guys are always so cool to me. I love it. And they always give me a nice beer. They have this pomegranate...
local? Is it a local beer?
No, they have the Scrimshaw, which is local up there, but they have...
I've heard of that.
This pomegranate one I always get when I'm up
really?
There. And, but it's a cider, a pomegranate cider. And it is so...
Carbonated or no?
Yeah.
Okay.
A little bit. And I think so. Yeah, just...
Was it got bubbly, fizzy?
Well, it tastes like a fizz, but it's not... It doesn't have foam like a beer.
Okay.
But I think so. Yeah, it's carbonated. And slightly carbonated. And it just... They go down so smooth. It's so refreshing. So when you have one of those paired with your fish and chips, it's like heaven.
It sounds like it.
It's like heaven. And these guys are just so awesome. Sea Pal out there.
I like a good fish and chips. You know, I don't eat a whole lot of fish, but fish and chips is awesome. And I'm one of those type of people, I'll eat the whole thing with my hands. You know, because it's breaded with the fish normally. Oh, yeah. You know, it's the thing of cod, and I'll just dip it in there.
Yeah, I don't think they give you a fork. I mean, you could get one, I'm sure, but you're right. You got everything's my hand.
Yeah.
And it's you know, just
and I'll even put the fries in the tartar sauce sometimes.
No, sorry, I forgot that part. So with the fries, after I put the malted vinegar all over there, I end up dipping them into the tartar sauce. There I don't use go. Ketchup. I don't use I ketchup
do
anymore.
Both, but yeah.
I used to do both, but lately I just go with the tartar sauce. Their tartar sauce goes so good with their steak fries. It's amazing. Yeah, I love ketchup, but I've been doing the whole thing with the tartar sauce up there. So
and this was in Fort Bragg, you said?
Yeah,
Fort Bragg. So that's on the ocean, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's all probably local caught fish, probably fresh fish.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I get that restaurants like that probably survive because they're local like that and it's fresh fish. And that's where all the people that fish, they got to, you know, sell their fish to.
Yeah, and they stayed open through the pandemic because people got to have their fish and chips, you know. So, I really enjoyed that. Just when I'm on the road, I forget how fun it can be, you know, we're talking post-pandemic, because now I get to go out to the restaurants again.
Yeah.
You know, I forgot to tell you.
And it's mostly mom and pop shops.
Yeah, and that's where it was. So I was in Fort Bragg for breakfast. I went to David's.
Let me guess, Eggs Benedict?
You know, I asked them about their Eggs Benedict, but they had the chicalelas on the...
What is that?
The chicalelas.
It's fun to say.
It's hard to say. Chicalelas, something like that.
I've heard of chiclets.
It almost sounds like Hawaiian, but it isn't. So what it is, they take...
It sounds Latin.
It is. They take the corn chips and then they... I got to find out exactly what they do, but they do something with the corn chips and they put the... And then they put the sauce on there and a little enchilada sauce on there.
Oh, is it a breakfast?
Yeah, and it's... And it,
like a huevos rancheros?
Yeah, but with... Yeah, because you get the eggs.
Is there an egg? Yeah.
You get the eggs and you get the beans.
Ooh.
Yeah,
and refried beans or what kind of beans?
Refried.
Yeah, 100%. I gotta go refried beans. I don't like it when they use black beans.
No, with cheese on top.
Yeah,
and then what they have is cilantro. Now I know not everybody's a cilantro fan, but I am. The chopped up cilantro with the chopped up diced red, was it the red onions? I think the red onions, but chopped up real small.
Yeah.
And then they poured that on top with two. I went over easy on the eggs.
Got to do.
And I've had it before at places where it's all the chicalelas, and that's pretty much all you get a plate of that. But when they serve it a la carte with the rice and beans and the eggs, I told the girls I would take a bite and mix a little of everything in there.
Yeah.
And I said at the end, it just finished equally. And I go, that was the best balance I've ever had with that dish. And I said, nobody has done it better than you guys.
Yeah, there you go.
It was a special. You know, and that's what I do. Sometimes I make a special or I take the special.
Yeah.
You know, or I go with my regular.
What do you do best? I'll try that.
Yeah, and that's why I always ask when I go to a new place, well, what is your specialty?
Yeah.
What do you take pride in?
Yeah.
What do you take pride in? Because if you don't take pride in it, I don't want to eat it.
Yep. Or ask what the people that work there, what do they like?
Yeah, I think it's real important. So, and that's the thing, communicating with waitresses again, you know, and talking and with people, and hey, how's your day going, you know? Back to the restaurants is what's making me really excited about you know, being in business with the Chili Gods, you know, is going and seeing my people. So yeah, I'm just blessed that everywhere I get to go to the best restaurants, you know, and now we're going around giving them all the stamp of approval, because the people that support quality and freshness like the Chili Gods, they are quality and freshness, you know. What is that, law of attraction? So it's good to be out there with the people again.
Yeah, there you go. It sounds like there's no rhyme or reason to the stores that made, I mean, besides quality and the people going to their favorite spots, the restaurants that made it and didn't. It feels like all the chain stores and all the big time spots, they all made it through. And what I've been doing, and especially in this, is because it's easy, is getting like Round Table and Mary's, you know, just pizza to go, you know.
You can never go wrong with that.
You know, I'm a huge fan of pizza. I consider it a food group.
Yeah, all in one, because you can put anything on a pizza.
Yeah,
you know, it's a base. It's a base with the bread. But you want to talk pizza?
Yeah,
the foundation of a pizza is the dough, and if you have the right dough, that's your foundation.
It seems like, especially with wheat-based products, especially with bread and stuff like that, like they have bread that's gone back with the wheat, whatever, for generations, right? Like, isn't that the whole, for some French breads, whatever, it's like, we have this, they have like a mother dough that they like clone almost.
Yeah, it's almost like the kombucha, where they have to take a little piece of the batch to start the next batch.
Yeah.
And I've heard that there, where they put a little bit into one that just carries over, and it's an interesting concept, and it's interesting thing that they do. But it's what they do, and it's what makes that bread so special, you know. And if the dough is not done right, and there's a lot of variables, it can be the exact amount of weight of all the ingredients, the flour, the milk, the oil, you know, whatever, the yeast, whatever,
the ratio,
could be exactly the same every time. But if there's humidity in the air when you're spinning the dough and blending the dough, it's going to affect the dough. And we could always tell, you know, and timing, and you're constantly throwing.
That's why probably every pizza place I've gone to, they got fans going. They all have hanging fans, it feels like.
Huh. Yeah,
because keep the temperature a certain place. I don't know.
All I know is that you have to, at the water and the yeast and is the catalyst with the flour and the oil to hold it all together and make it pliable. But you know, if you do too much of one thing, it could come out almost rubbery. It could come out too doughy, you know.
Yeah.
So anyway, what I'm saying is, the base of the foundation is the crust, and it's a lot of we could tell when we were spinning it. Was spinning like, oh, it's going to be good today. It's going to be extra good today, because it was never the same, exactly the same. You know, never. It could be never exactly the same. It's going to be close.
Yeah.
But never. And sometimes it would rise a little bit more and get more bready. And then sometimes it would stay a little lower. And, you know, but it all. And it also depend how long we had it sit.
Before it went in the oven?
Yeah.
And these are brick ovens or industrial?
Oh, these were the old school pizza ovens that you know. I think they have to warm up. But yeah, because guys had to go in there early and turn on before. So they had to warm up, you know, a few hours before the doors open, you know. So they would go in early and the preppers and get the ovens stoked. Because I think the ovens got up there pretty hot.
And some of those ovens I've seen on TV shows, some of those ovens are like 20, 30, 40, 50 years old. They've been using them forever.
Yeah.
And that's part of what makes a pizza so good. It's just that built up.
Yeah.
We'll go back to the word marinated goodness of cooking over the years.
Yeah. And you know what? The oven has a lot to do with, because I remember the bottom oven always burnt the pizzas, where the top oven seemed to have that better temperature. Where we work, but like you said, at Gas House Pizza, it was an old pizza oven. I mean, it was really old, but it had a lot of character, you know. And we also used the freshest ingredients, and that's why we were voted by the Chico News and Review every year as the best pizza. And Woodstock came in second, which was pretty awesome. Woodstock's is still around. They're actually one of my clients, and they're opening up, so they're going to start serving my sauce again. So they definitely get the Chili God stamp of approval, because great quality. I love Woodstock's, I love going to Chico. So yeah, I had a really, really good trip this week with all the restaurants that I went to. We had just a great time. Everybody was once again in a better mood. Like I said, some of the smaller places I went to, people were a little bit more, you know, standoffish a little bit, you know, with the masks and stuff. But that was nothing like when we were in the middle of the pandemic. So hopefully we have clear skies moving forward, and just a better life for everybody out there.
Yeah, but going back to the pizzas and... There's all different kinds of pizzas.
You could do anything with a pizza.
Yeah. So my favorite is probably pepperoni. Standard. Yeah, I'll get, depending on where I'm at or what I'm doing, I'll get a half pepperoni, half combination.
Yeah.
And then I'll go, I don't necessarily always use them, but always on GP, I'll get anchovies and shrimp on the side, because I'll throw those on my combination.
Ooh, okay. You're getting funky with it there.
Yeah.
But, you know, the pepperoni, I think, is, now you're thinking about it, it's just made for pizza. It's such a classic. Yeah. But you ever go say, can I get a pepperoni sandwich? No.
No.
But you always say, can I get a pepperoni pizza?
It's different. The pepperoni's got to be warm.
Isn't that a trip?
Yeah, because I don't know what else you use pepperoni for. I mean, I guess you could use it in charcuterie with, like, crackers and cheese.
Or, you could put it in your poor boy. Yeah. But you can't have, it's hard to have just a pepperoni sandwich.
Yeah, but I don't think pizza, they do that. It's perfect.
It works.
It's one of those things. Like,
now, are you one of those guys that likes the thick ones or the real thin ones?
Real thin.
Yeah, sometimes when it's crispy, it's almost like bacon, huh?
Yeah, it depends. But yeah, I like it when it's fresh, you know, especially like when I've been in a luxury, I've lived close to a pizza place, and you get it and it's just hot and fresh like that.
Yeah.
And there'll be a couple of the pepperonis might be overcooked, but I like them. I like it when it's just done just right, you know. And pizza's one of those things where... it feels like you always eat it just a little bit too quickly, as far as you should have waited maybe a minute or two, because I always will burn my mouth. It feels like, you know, because I'll just eat it when it's just way too hot, like fresh out the oven.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's one of those things that, like, I would love to take a trip and just have, like, because I know that they got New York. New York is, like, they say the Mecca, whatever, for pizza. Then you got Chicago deep dish. You know, and then in California, they have everything. You know, we
California do, cuisine. Yeah.
We do all kinds of different pizzas. And then they have like the, what is it? The, what is the pizza?
Oh, do you ever have the one of those like white sauce?